All right, Left Reckoners, welcome episode 36. I'm Matt Leck, with me as always, David Griscom. Hello, David.
Hey, man, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. In that cold open there, the YouTube and Twitch and Facebook viewers would have seen workers in Anatolia take a backhoe and crush some other heavy machinery owned by the capitalists after a period of not working without pay. And that, and not Bitcoin, is how people get empowered. I just want to say that.
Man, take this job and shove it, baby.
Oh, man. Like, I do think, like, that threat... We've talked about Blair Mountain recently. Like, the threat of, I'm just going to, I think somebody commented on the post, like, I'm just going to throw your stuff in the river if you keep abusing me and taking advantage of that you control my wages. That threat disappearing is one of, I think, the bigger problems we're dealing with in our era of history. But
yeah, exactly. I mean, sometimes it's important to be able to, like, break down those, I don't know, social barriers for how we're supposed to be treating bosses, etc.
Yeah, and then this is the part where if DRM and IP laws, I'd be playing Beastie Boys Sabotage right now very loudly, because I think that's the way we need to look at things. Sabotage is good.
Oh, yeah. Have you ever heard the Johnny Cash song Oni before, Matt?
I don't think so.
No, it's one of my favorite songs. I mean, I won't go through the whole thing right now, but it's a song about a guy who's been working on a factory line his whole life, and he's just waiting for, like, the end of the day, his last day, because he's going to go and find his boss, Oni, and punch him in the mouth. And the entire song, though, is, like, him sort of breaking down how, like, you know, while Oni's been getting all fat and soft, sitting there, like, supervising all of us, I've turned myself into, like, this powerful machine, and I'm really going to kick his ass. It's kind of old school.
Exactly. And that is a pretty timeless message, I think. That song, unless something goes really, really well, that song's going to be probably, you know, just as applicable in, like, 100 years and 200 years.
Unfortunately, yes. But we got a lot to get to, y'all, this evening. I'm really excited. This is a full show. In just a little bit, we're going to be joined by Darna Noor, who's going to help us, who is a really great journalist, and she's going to help break down what's been going on with Entergy, which is a utility company that services Louisiana that has basically left hundreds of thousands of people without power during the most recent hurricane and beyond. But even worse than that is that this is a company that has deep roots in American history and has, from the get-go, been one of the leading fighters in denying climate science. So we'll get into that history and all of that. And then later in the show, something Matt and I have been, I don't know, have we been avoiding it? Have we been just sort of sitting, you know, waiting to give it to people at the right time? Matt and I are going to do our big final breakdown on Bitcoin. I think we were just a little bit too tired of the emails and the comments. We just wanted to have one video we could put up there.
Yeah.
And say, if you want to hear our thoughts on Bitcoin, you can go there. So we'll have that coming up.
Yeah. David's for some reason optimistic that this will be the last time we talk about it, but we're going to put the effort in that would make it the last time we talk about it. Now, whether the conditions agree with that remain to be seen.
This is going to be, Bitcoin's going to completely collapse after.
I mean, that would be, talk about a feather in the cap of a leftist YouTube show, is tanking cryptocurrency. The final take.
And then, you know, plenty more in the post game. I just want to pitch for folks who didn't get a chance to see it. Our recent episode with Chuck Keeney on the Battle of Blair Mountain, I think, was one of my favorite bonus episodes we've done in a while. We went through the history of Blair Mountain and also how to fight and preserve our radical history. It was a really great conversation.
It's one that, like, of all the different sort of notes in the chord, in the Left Reckoning chords, it plays all of them in like, really, like, the history, the labor's, like, radicalism, and the needing to stand up to coercion, and the fundamental interest of the state in maintaining that coercion. I mean, really, everything. So yeah, Chuck is great, and I really, really love that conversation.
Yeah, and to get access to that, you know, join us at patreon.com/leftreckoning,
where we just crossed 900 patrons.
I know, man. I'm really excited about that.
And I said at 1,000, I'm going to be going to visit Austin. So I'm excited. I mean, hopefully a COVID situation is improved there. I mean, David did send me a whole bunch of honky tonk videos through the summer, but that's, I think, a bit slowed down a little bit of late, maybe.
Well, I did just get a big shipment of wood in. So yeah, y'all, if you're listening, you're still on the fence, chip in now and let's get Matt to Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
But before we get to all of that, we do have to talk about something pretty serious and somber. We're going to turn our attention real quick to Palestine. And if you have this handy, Matt, this is from our friends, Daniel Bessner and Derek Davison. You should definitely be subscribing to their Substack, FX. It's a great place to get your international news. But we have this basically report from last weekend. The Israeli military bombed Gaza on Monday in response to overnight rocket fire out of the enclave, the third day in a row that particular exchange has taken place. As was the case on the first 2 days, there are no reports of any casualties apart that this is from efforts to negotiate a more durable Gaza ceasefire, which certainly took a hit this weekend. And that's fine there. You know, so basically Gaza has been under rocket fire again. And people should remember that, you know, just as recently as May, Gaza and Israel were engaged in horrific hostilities that ended up killing over 260 Palestinians, right? And there had been hope that this ceasefire was going to be able to hold off any more bloodshed. But Israel has come back with a vengeance, especially after what has happened in these past couple of weeks with six prisoners escape from a high security prison by digging a tunnel with spoons. Just a really, really amazing story about, you know, human ingenuity, but most importantly, human spirit and the Palestinian fighting spirit that no matter what the odds and the circumstances are, they will always be fighting for freedom. And it's been something that the spoon itself has taken on a role as a symbol. I even saw videos of people in Washington, D.C. at a protest outside of the Israeli embassy throwing spoons.
That's awesome.
Outside of the embassy there.
We've had some good symbols lately between the pencil and now the spoon.
Absolutely. You know, yeah, that's true. And, you know, people should know, like, the people who escaped were, you know, wide range of, you know, charges against them. But I wanted to note that one of them has been held all this time under administrative detention. And we'll get into what that is and why that's a problem very, very soon. But I really wanted to take the time, one, to highlight the heroism of that moment, remind people that Israel is very much, returning to putting Gaza in the crosshairs, and also to highlight what's going on in the prison system in Israel, which is egregious. Just in response to these prisoners who have left, there has been a campaign that you have to call collective punishment. And we'll get to some of the responses to that in a second. But I want to note that as of now, four of the six people who escaped from prison have been captured again. They were held without access to their lawyers, without access to communication with the outside world. And just today, one of the lawyers, and if you could pull this up, Matt, this first Al Jazeera piece, one of the lawyers for a Palestinian prisoner has claimed that he has been tortured. The claims basically are that they were held, they were shackled both arms and legs to a wall. They were held naked, so sexual humiliation. They were refused water, they were refused food, and they were refused sleep. And that's only one of the people who's been able to meet with their lawyer. There'll be more information coming out soon.
I mean, just undeniably true, right? You can just imagine how much they want to catch these guys. And one, punish them for embarrassing them in the first place. But also, like, yes, of course they're torturing these guys.
Yeah. No, exactly. And I just want to remind folks of two things, right? Let's take them first to this first tweet, Matt, which is what the response is looking like it's going to be. People need to understand that the conditions that prisoners are held in Israel, much like the United States, are abhorrent. They are anti-human, and they are something that should be just fundamentally condemned. And there is a movement right now of Palestinian prisoners to go on hunger strike. This is from Mohammed El-Kurd, who, by the way, this is great news, is now going to be the Palestinian bureau chief for the nation. So congratulations on that.
Very good.
But 1,380, that's the number of Palestinian prisoners who will go on a hunger strike this Friday, protesting the brutal and collective punishment measures implemented by the occupation authorities after last week's historic jailbreak. Our duty is to advocate for their freedom. Absolutely true. And we'll get back to the prisoners and the conditions that they're in, but understand that collective punishment is not just directed at prisoners. Matt, if you have this video of what's happened to these children, you know, this is the kind of thing that happens.
So I just want to make sure my DMs are close. Yeah.
This is from the IMEU. And this is a video of children leaving their school because Israeli soldiers have fired tear gas canisters at a Palestinian elementary school in the occupied West Bank, which required around a few dozen children to flee the facility, right? Collective punishment is one of those things. It's not just limited to the prisoners, but we wanted to spend some time highlighting, you know, prison conditions in Israel this evening in support of the people going on hunger strike. So if you have this first one from Al Jazeera, there's this infographic. If you could just scroll down a little bit, I wanted to highlight the amount of people who are in prisons. Here we go. In Palestine, Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. So Israel holds around 4,650 prisoners. 200 of them are children, 40 of them are women, and 520 of them are administrative detainees. And that's it for the graphic there. That's a significant amount of people that Israel's holding. They are held in really brutal conditions. And ever since these people escaped from prison, this high security prison, all prisoners that are held by Palestinians that are held by Israel have faced what has to be understood as collective punishment. That means random searches. That means being moved forcibly from their cells into other areas. There are videos over the past couple of years of people being beaten inside of these facilities indiscriminately while tied down. It's very, very rare that you can get any kind of videos out of these facilities because they are very, very much locked down. Needless to say, this is a place that you don't want to be. This is a place where human rights are abused regularly. And these people going on hunger strike is just a way for them to fight back. And it's important for us in the United States in particular to make sure that we are seeing what's happening there so that we can advocate and put pressure on our fucking government, which is a big part of the reason that this kind of monstrosity is allowed to happen. And I want to hear your thoughts in a second. And there's a place I want to direct people to, a call to action in just a moment. But I did want to note one specific thing that I think some people are not familiar with, which is what these administrative detainees are. Right. These are people who were tried essentially in they don't have to have any charges brought against them. Right. And they can just sit in limbo forever until the military decides that they want to bring up charges against them. This is the most basic violation of anybody's civil liberties. Right. This is a basic concept. If you are imprisoned, you are told why you are in prison and you have the right on a very basic level to have a reasonably timed trial. There are people who have been sitting for decades in these positions, including one of the Met people who escaped from prison recently. So, you know, absolute solidarity to people on hunger strike. And we need to be putting pressure, one, to end the occupation, but two, to make sure that the rights of these prisoners are highlighted, particularly the ones who don't even have any charges against them. They're just sort of sitting in legal limbo.
Yeah. I mean, like the Guantanamo Bay sort of procedure, just I guess we need to lock people up without any sort of rights. That's a necessity of certain kinds of states these days.
And we'll put this in the show notes, but if you could just go to the call to action, Matt, just to share this with people.
Yep.
This is at damir.com. And this is a call to action. Join Adam Meir's campaign against Israeli court, against Israeli military courts. And it has a few different, I can't read it on the screen here, but it has a few different ways that people can get involved, and some information about the military court system and why it needs to be abolished. So we'll put a link to there. It has some places that you can take action, some places that you can send letters, and emails, et cetera. You know, if you have some time today, I highly suggest that you do this, because this is egregious abuse of human beings. And the Palestinian people need to always be, you know, covered in, you know, in the public eye, especially in this country, to make sure that we can see an end to the occupation in our lifetime. And as a little preview for later, there's one thing that people in Palestine don't need, and that's fucking Bitcoin.
See, the guy who writes these, and we're going to talk about this in depth, but
we're going to talk about this in depth, and I'm sure we'll even do this piece in depth later, but this piece just really sickens me in a lot of ways. And we're going to break down why Bitcoin is a problem and why these kind of things I think are exceptionally egregious. But essentially, you know, these people are arguing that if people who have no other opportunities in their life or in impoverished areas invest in Bitcoin at the right time, then they can make some money. It's really, really sickening. And just sort of shows how perverse that kind of Bitcoin ideology can be. And also, let's not forget that this is like, again, Bitcoin Magazine, you know, making these kind of claims. Obviously, they have a motive there as well. But, you know, the people in Palestine need your solidarity and your political support in a serious way, not some fucking half-assed technocratic crypto scheme.
Gladstein is apparently with the Human Rights Foundation as well, but I haven't seen him write on Bukele.
The thing about that piece too, I mean, we don't have time to read through it right now. We should get to our next interview. But the thing about the piece that's so frustrating to me is like they do highlight like the problems of the occupation. What's sickening to me is to, like, to understand the problems of the occupation and then to turn and say like, yeah, and what, you know, if they just gone on to into this
to scheme, use it as a vehicle.
Yeah.
To use it as a vehicle for their fucking asset. It's exactly. So you said it right. It's evil. Like if someone could emanate like the smell of sulfur through a tweet, like that's that sort of stuff. It's disgusting.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, we're going to take a very, very, very brief break, and we'll be right back with Darna Noor. We'll be right back.
back.
Welcome back, everybody. We are very happy to be joined this evening by Darna Noor, who is an Earther staff writer. She writes really great pieces on a wide variety of subjects touching climate and environmental justice. But in particular, we're going to talk about a couple of pieces, one about Entergy and its history and its effects in Louisiana, and also a bit on Texas and the Green New Deal. But before we get to all that, how are you doing today, Darna?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. I love what y'all are doing with Left Reckoning. So it's really cool to be here.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. I mean, it's always great to have a real news alum too. That's always been such a big influence on us.
Oh yeah. Well, thanks. Yeah, they're great folks.
Let's start with Entergy. And you know, I'm sure most people watching this obviously know about this. You know, Hurricane Ida. Which was a really devastating hurricane. I have family who lived there, and they basically were unable to return to their home for over 14 days. And working people across the country know that situations like that mean you lose wages. So along with property damage and the, you know, being sort of forced out of your home, a lot of people are in a much worse position today than they were a few weeks ago. On top of that, we have been seeing horrifying reports of elderly people passing away because they did not have electricity because the grid failed there. It just shows a lot of the intersections between a profit motive, a kind of head in the sand attitude toward climate change, and a lot of the failures too of our public spaces and city governments. But I don't want to load the question too much. Let's start very basic. Could you help us understand, for people who aren't familiar, what is Entergy and what happened to the grid in Louisiana after Ida?
Yeah, totally. So Entergy is a utility. It's a utility company. As you mentioned, a profit-focused utility company. It's investor-owned. It's private. It's actually a Fortune 500 company, just to, like, lay the land a little bit. And it serves millions of people, like 3 million people in southern states, including Louisiana and a few other ones, too. And when Hurricane Ida touched down a couple of weeks ago, as you said, it really devastated the whole region. And it took down 8 transmission lines, I believe, that deliver electricity to the entire city of New Orleans, meaning that like more than 1 million people in New Orleans and the surrounding areas lost power. It's now 2 weeks later, by the way, and there's still like tens of thousands of people who don't have power still. So while they're reporting like, oh, you know, we're like 90% or 98% or whatever it is back online, that still means that there's tens of thousands of people who don't have power 2 weeks after a storm, which is just like totally unconscionable. And, you know, just to give a little more background, I guess, this isn't the first time that this happened, right? Like Hurricane Rita and Katrina, both in 2005, back to back. Both also took out Entergy power lines in Louisiana. There's been instances before then, instances since then. So it's not like this should come as some big surprise. Like there's a storm, there's big winds, you know, that's what it does. It like takes down power lines. But after those storms in 2005, the company had like millions of dollars in repairs that it had to make, and it didn't make them. Instead, it filed for bankruptcy, as these private companies do. And, you know, storm after storm hit and it failed to take precautions. And this is, it's of course, working people, ordinary people who are bearing the brunt of that. So,
yeah. And I mean, again, like this is a story about Entergy, but it really is a story about like a kind of model about the way that we power our communities. And, you know, again, sometimes it can seem a little wonky to folks, but this is really fucking important stuff. And you might not think about what the forces are that, you know, make that power your home, for example, most of the time, but when you try to turn on the switch and it doesn't turn on, like, you know, it's one of those things that like, it's important to start, you know, laying the groundwork for thinking about this politically. But Entergy, reading your piece, I was really interested because I didn't know much about their history. Could you tell us a little bit about their history? Because it's an old company, and specifically like their history, before we get into their opposition, their recent opposition, but their history basically of their knowledge of the incoming climate crisis.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and honestly, like there's so much more here that I don't know about either. Like these utility companies, part of the reason I think that like so many of us don't know these things is because these utility companies are so powerful that like, Yeah, they're never really held to account in that way, whatever that means. So as you mentioned, Entergy has been around for like 100 years, but it's gone under a bunch of different names. But yeah, it's been around for like a century. And in the 30s, it was a founding member of this industry group called the Edison Electric Institute, which, the names don't really matter. And it was a part of these other big utility industry groups too. And these groups basically like convene fossil fuel companies and utilities and like get them ready for like coming markets, like prepare them from a business perspective for like what the world is going to need, what consumers are demanding. And it turns out that like, surprise, surprise, these industry groups were getting briefed by climate scientists since like the 1960s. Like way before this was even on most people's radar at all. Not totally shocking. This is the US. We have like a history of cutting edge science just being used to protect profits and like uplift capitalists. But whatever, it knew that climate change was happening, and it knew that it was happening because of oil and gas. And importantly, it has also known for decades that that climate change would put its transmission lines at risk, like that it would screw up its stuff. In New Orleans and elsewhere. And it didn't tell anyone. It didn't take steps really to get better prepared. I know we'll get into that a little bit more. Let alone like definitely did not take any steps to get off of these climate warming fossil fuels in the first place. We talk a lot, I think, in like the climate world about how big oil companies like Exxon and Shell and stuff like that have known for a long time about climate change. But I think utilities like Entergy bear a lot of responsibility too. So,
I mean, no doubt. And like, again, this is one of those things where, so yeah, as you know, like these gas companies, these oil companies, you think about a lot, but like, electricity production is a huge part of, our carbon footprint. And it is amazing totally. How often they get away with this.
For sure.
I think it will be of no surprise to anybody, but how receptive has Entergy been to decarbonizing?
I mean, again, like big surprise. They have really consistently opposed any efforts to do basically anything to better prepare for climate change or to get off oil and gas, to make the grid more resilient, like anything that we need to do in terms of, our energy grid. To prepare for the climate crisis and help curb the climate crisis, it's opposed. I guess to get into specifics a little bit, last year it announced this plan that it was going to reach net zero carbon emissions, basically meaning like no more carbon, and whatever carbon we do produce, we're going to offset it, which is like a whole other problem. But it's got this whole plan, like we're going to become green, we're going to become sustainable. And the way that it says that it's going to do that is by expanding the use of natural gas, which is not clean, produces tons of carbon and other planet warming fossil fuels. I think currently like maybe the single biggest contributor to climate change is actually the expansion of natural gas, at least in the US. So definitely not a climate solution by any means.
I mean, it's a good marketing solution.
Honestly. Totally. Yeah. It's so true. And it's wild that they can still get away with that. Just like absurd and like obvious lying, but yeah.
I mean, that's one of the useful, so when they call it an integrated company, what does that mean? Like, cause this is a private company, as you mentioned earlier, as opposed to a public utility. I feel like a public utility maybe wouldn't be allowed to lie. And like you said earlier, like we know less about this probably in part because again it's private, which is like that's one of the way we structure things in America, and it's convenient that it always seems to serve sort of like fossil fuel interests or other industries we just prioritize.
Yeah, totally. I mean, being a privately owned company obviously means like you give money to your shareholders, you are profit focused. But like you're saying, it also means that there's just like a lot less transparency around anything that they can do. And like, not that obviously like publicly owned entities haven't also like kind of engaged in the same kind of stuff, but, I think it's kind of no question that like the profit motive is also a driver. So.
Yeah. And, you know, and the thing is, like, which is so sickening about these, you know, private companies, and like here in Texas, it's a nightmare. I mean, the deregulation is terrible.
Yeah.
You know, but there is ostensibly like some level of oversight. And as you know, in this piece, like Entergy does not really play fair when it comes to public campaigns and people sort of demanding that, you know, they have more resilient grid. I mean, something that you would definitely expect you would want to build in a place like New Orleans, or, you know, or just more green. Energy's had some pretty nasty, has been exposed doing some pretty underhanded things to prevent any kind of city council moves to change their behavior.
Yeah, it has. I think maybe maybe not the worst, but like maybe one of the most shocking, I guess, things that Energy has done is a couple of years ago, this investigation from these Louisiana outlets found that Energy hired actors through a PR firm to show up at these city council meetings in like 2017, 2018, I think, basically like astroturfing support for gas expansion, for a new gas plant in New Orleans. For obvious reasons, there was just like widespread local opposition. People were, you know, rightfully really up in arms about the fact that there was going to be more polluting infrastructure, especially like in communities that are already faced with lots and lots of pollution. But yeah, it hired this PR firm to hire 60 actors, I think, like put tens of thousands of dollars into coming to hearings. Yeah, obviously it denied this until it didn't anymore and got taken to court for it.
Yeah, let's share. We have a WDSU News Channel 6 story on this. It is amazing. And yeah. I think like the way they talk about hiring people, I would like to see more emails from firms saying, yeah, we can put people in that crowd, but you'll see. Sorry, 1 second. I got other audio playing on my.
It's not that bad yet.
Yeah. No, sorry.
It is fascinating though, like especially at that period of time, what 2019, that was like the whole paid protester movement, right? When pretty much any time there's a left wing movement, there is a claim that it's, oh, you know, the left is just paying protesters to show up.
Projection.
Oh my gosh, it's so true. Like, I mean, the whole reason I think that anyone believes that is because there is actually a history of that kind of stuff in the US. It's not the left that's doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like we talked about last week, it's like them projecting their desires. Like, I wish we either have that capability or we will have that capability soon.
For sure.
Stella, this report claims Entergy not only knew they were paying for people to speak in support of their power plant, but did it anyway, despite the advice from the third-party group that they hired, saying that this was war. Entergy had claimed earlier this year that a third party hired the actors and that they didn't know that's what was happening. Mm. But take a look at this conversation revealed between Entergy and that company, the Hawthorne Group. In September 2017, the Hawthorne Group actually told Entergy they didn't recommend these standalone crowd building efforts, saying people will question who are these people and why did they turn out. But the Hawthorne Group still provided pricing showing, for example, 10 supporters to sign in and speak would cost $6,500. The next day, Entergy agreed. And then later on, former Entergy CEO texted this to a colleague: if Hawthorne can get more people, I will pay. This is war and we need all the foot soldiers that we can muster. So this report claims Entergy knew what they were paying for and alleges those paid actors showed up for a meeting in October of last year and February of this year. And it also says Entergy executives contemplating using similar tactics at an additional hearing in December 2017, but eventually decided against such action. Now, this independent investigation was initiated by the city council, who voted back in March to approve the plan. It's unclear how this report will impact that vote. Now, we did also speak to Entergy Corporation tonight, who said they are reviewing these findings and hope to have more answers tomorrow. We certainly will to follow this story.
Yeah. Well, reviewing who spilled the beans.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Give us a day to figure out what exactly we're going to say that we did here. But
yeah, it's a very powerful news voice in that one too. But I mean, this is it's very funny, but it's so egregious. And, you know, we also can't forget like what the consequences of these things are.
Totally.
It's devastation. Yeah. But this isn't the only thing that Entergy's done when it comes to fighting resiliency, right? Didn't they also threaten a lawsuit too, in your, that you noted in your piece?
They did. They threatened to sue the city of New Orleans, I guess it was, for... So in 2019, there was like this big movement in New Orleans to pass this thing called a resilient renewable portfolio standard, which is like, basically there are renewable portfolio standards, which are like, here's how much clean energy we need to use. And then this was adding another piece, which was like, and we also need to make our grid actually resilient to storms and hurricanes and, you know, make it so that we can actually get power when there's a lot of rain and a lot of wind and things like this. And Entergy was like not too pleased about New Orleans passing a policy like that, so it threatened to sue the city. Obviously, these efforts have like worsened the climate crisis, made like catastrophic damage to the grid all but inevitable. But the emails there are also like really really funny. Entergy is just like a wildly egregious when it comes to like any sort of public communications. It's like they forget that like anybody will ever be able to see these emails besides them.
Yeah, this is war. We need foot soldiers. Like, dude, have some coffee.
Yeah, like, totally. Like, or at least like, I don't know, figure out some better way to communicate this that people aren't gonna like be able to, you know, FOIA or like whatever public information requests.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, yeah, it's truly amazing. I mean, it's like last week we were talking about the EpiPen scandal and, you know, some of those emails are amazing.
Totally.
Too. It's like, you know, can you find a medical use for this marketing plan that
we're putting together? For I need a medical justification on my desk by tomorrow at 9 a.m. Like,
man. Yeah. No, totally. Those emails are, I mean, I think that this is like a, it's crazy, right? Because I think what that also means is like all of these corporations just feel like there's no way that anything bad can ever happen to them for anything. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, well, we can get away with saying basically whatever we want because we have all the money and all the power. And like, no matter what we say in our emails and whatever people figure out, like we're still going to win. So,
and essentially they have a monopoly, you know, like, and that, I mean, that's like, again, I don't think competition is the answer to this problem either. You can see what that's like here in Texas. It's a nightmare as well. You don't want to have like six different electrical lines going into people's house, right? That doesn't make any kind of sense. But you know, these kind of, I mean, it's amazing to me that there, you even get to have like as much of a profit motive in the US. Because yeah, these companies just get to be monopolies. They aren't really threatened by the city. And you know, when the city or you know, the democratic community tries to challenge it, they threaten them with lawsuits and all this kind of crazy shit.
Yeah, totally.
And we'll get into some of that in a minute, but I also want to talk about, you know, another piece that you wrote on, you know, the Texas Green New Deal and union power. People are probably familiar who watch this show a lot. We're big fans of the Texas Climate Jobs Project. We've had really great conversations with Ryan Pollack, both on this channel and on TMBS as well, about fighting for a Green New Deal in Texas through union power. But I'm just sort of curious because, you know, you spend a lot of time, you know, dealing with, you know, the environmental movement and thinking about climate justice. When you saw this plan, what were your sort of takeaways? You know, where was it, you know, feeling encouraging to feel like there was a shift, or there are parts of it that you really like? I mean, what are your general thoughts on the plan?
I mean, yeah, totally. I was really, really excited to see the plan. And like, I think the whole framing of the plan is maybe the most exciting thing about it, which is that it's a climate plan, sure, but it's a climate plan that leads with jobs. It's a climate plan that like, you don't have to be an environmentalist or even like concerned about climate change to support. And I mean, I'm sure like, you know, as you said, viewers of the show know this already, but it's, was endorsed by, the Texas AFL-CIO, which includes tons of people who work in the fossil fuel industry, which is pretty amazing. You know, unions in the fossil fuel industry agreeing to policies that could, in theory, like threaten, you know, sectors where they're really strong. But it does that by saying like, and we need to build out green sectors and we need to unionize them, like not just like, you know, do green growth and then we'll like catch up to you with our unions and later, like whenever we get to it. But instead, like, you know, we're going to build out the sector through our union and we're going to give our union people like the work that's needed to build out the new green sector. Yeah, there's lots of really good stuff in it.
Yeah, and I think like I just want to note a couple of things and hear your thoughts on them too. It's like, you know, you talk to people like Ryan Politic, you talk to a lot of people who are like really in the sector, and there's problems with a lot of green industry in general, primarily that it's not unionized, right?
Yeah.
So Texas has a lot of wind power, but the vast majority of that is not union labor, and you're not going to make as much. You know, money. You're also going to be forced oftentimes to work in poor conditions. And there's this kind of, you know, it's similar in some ways to working at like a progressive organization or something like that. Like, oh, you're doing good work.
Oh,
or
yeah,
you need to accept like the bullshit that comes with it. And it's like, absolutely not. And on top of that too, I think that people need to understand, I mean, obviously fossil fuels have been, or I mean, are undeniably damaging to the planet, right? But understanding that for a lot of working people in Texas and in these areas, that was a kind of blue collar escape from, you know, kind of being working poor your whole life, right? Getting a job in those industries for a lot of people was their ticket, or at least was a hope of something better. And, you know, working conditions is very dramatically in it, but like understanding why some people might be resistant to you coming for their livelihood, I think is something that we have to really wrestle with as a movement that's trying to get environmental justice and making sure that we have a livable planet in the future.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And like, I think it's also worth noting that the fossil fuel industry is not some amazing, like exemplary employer either. So it's pretty notable that like the green sector is even worse than that. Like, rates of fossil fuel industry unionization are not super high. You know, it's super dangerous. Like, there's mass layoffs all the time. They don't take care of workers. Everything is about like executives' paychecks and paying off shareholders, et cetera. You know, similar to what we just talked about with Entergy. But the green sector, I think, repeats a lot of those same mistakes and then is even worse because there's not this like long history of union power. So yeah, I mean, it's impressive in some ways that like green sectors can be even worse than that.
Oh yeah, no, and you're right too about like, you know, I don't want people to misunderstand me and saying that the oil and gas industry is some wonderful employer. I think one of the arguments too that you know, was made in sort of pitching this as well to folks was look at what happened during the shutdowns last year. That was a preview of what a future could look like for you. And what happened there for people who are unfamiliar, you know, there was a slowdowns in production, right? And there were just mass layoffs of like the workers while, you know, white collar folks, people in Houston and Dallas, you know, in the big office buildings were getting taken care of. Some of them were, you know, being laid off, but they're being laid off with very nice severance. While the people who literally are putting themselves at risk constantly, we're just being shown the door, right?
Yeah,
and one of the points that was made, you know, that I know was made to folks is like, this is what will happen in a future where we don't sort of take initiative now to, you know, take control of what this future is going to look like, because they don't give a shit about you.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And like, you know, maybe it's better to work for an employer who cares about climate change in some broad sense, but like, just because someone cares about climate change doesn't mean that they give a shit about you as a worker either. So yeah, the way that you get power as a worker isn't by like, you know, having like a nice boss who believes in climate change, it's by organizing. So
yeah, no, exactly. And I mean, I agree with you totally that like this was an encouraging plan one, because I think that this kind of shift is the shift if we want to win, right? It's like understanding that a Green New Deal or, you know, environmental policy. I mean, that's the one thing though, is that they do have to shy away from using that terminology because there is such a media apparatus that sort of poisons people's minds against them. But again,
for sure,
people want union jobs. They want high paying things. Figure out a way to put the spin on it that you need to. I'm not too concerned.
The basic rephrase is, sorry to cut you off, but the basic rephrase is like, instead of focusing on how to incentivize the capitalists, is to start with the workers.
Yeah.
And like, who would have thought that would be a better approach?
Yeah. I mean, who would have thought that working people would want jobs and like job security?
How many people's ears just shut off when they're like hearing about incentives, even about like things you want? Like, oh yeah, I hope the government's doing incentives about solar panels. It's like, cool. I'd love that. But I mean, I'm not a capitalist. I'm not like going to be, you know, starting a company to install these things in my local community, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And it's also like to that point, there's tons of stuff in this plan that I think is also just good for like regular people who are not in these sectors too. Mm-hmm. Like, even if you're not a unionized employee, even if you're not in the AFL-CIO in Texas or whatever, you know, there's like plans, for instance, to expand rail and things like this. And like, you know, maybe you don't even care about climate change. Maybe you don't even really believe that climate change is real or whatever. Like, who cares? You want to be able to get around better. Like, you want to be able to like not have to drive around.
I-35 is a pain in the ass.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And that's, I think, like, that's the kind of climate policy that I would hope that we can all sort of move toward, like, around the country, is the kind of climate policy that's like good for everyone and also is decarbonizing.
Yeah, yeah, and I agree completely. And you know, also, like, it's really inspiring too, because like, we're gonna have to touch a lot of different things to be able to decarbonize. Why not make things better, right? Versus the kind of bleak austerity kind of, you know, green policy. It's like, let's pitch people a better future. And, you know, we talk a lot with our friend Matt Huber about things like this, but I'm curious what your feelings are on this. Is that, you know, I do feel like there has been a little bit of a shift within the environmental movement to sort of making this positive pitch, you know, connecting like a green future with, you know, things like the labor struggle, democracy, racial justice, et cetera. Like, how would you sort of, you know, top line feel about that? How do you see the development is what I'm trying to say of that? Do you think that's starting to become a winning message within the environmental community, or is there still a lot of work to do?
It's hard. Actually, you know, it's funny. You mentioned Matt Huber, and he recently pointed to, I think in something that he wrote, he pointed to a poll that showed that a decreasing number of Americans identify as environmentalists, which I think kind of tells you like a lot about what we need to know about how to make climate policy. Yeah, I think that definitely like there's lots of room in the environmental movement to grow. And there also has been a lot of growth in terms of working with unions, in terms of like putting jobs at the forefront, and messaging in that way, like really, really organizing with those principles in mind. You know, like folks like, I think the Sunrise Movement putting it on the map, and then, you know, kind of taking up that and really putting it to work with folks like the DSA Eco-Socialists. But also, I think what's really exciting about projects like this in Texas is that I don't think that a lot of folks who worked on this plan or who endorsed this plan would really even consider themselves part of like the environmental movement as such. And I think that, again, like it's really cool to hear folks who are not even concerned about like environmental issues as such, most importantly. You know, it's like in addition to taking on the biggest crisis that is facing humanity, we can also have better lives and better jobs and stuff like that. So that, I mean, like, it's very heartening to see stuff like this. Definitely, there's a lot more work to be done.
Well, it's because it's shabby anyway. Like, it's, you look at what happened in the face of Ida, and you have like old women falling downstairs because the lights are out and getting stuck without help, and like that absolutely shouldn't be happening. It's disgusting, and how much we tolerate that, and kind of like, you know, I mean, this is like the sort of a point people make a lot. Like, oh my goodness, we're so, all this stuff is normalized, but like we lost a whole bunch of people in Texas to power outages. Like, it's scary how like just like sort of a background drumbeat this is becoming in our lives,
and
until it becomes like, I guess, a foreground one because it's our community itself.
Totally, but then you're expected to like move, even when it does come to the foreground, you're expected to just like move on and be like, oh right. Well, you know, whatever, life's not fair, like,
yeah, bad luck.
Yeah
It's amazing here because like there's been sort of like murmurs of like reporting that, you know, they're thinking it might be another winter like last year. And really when it comes to resiliency, like not enough has been done. I knew that the one thing that people were going to get worked up about, was about like the, you know, the board having people who weren't in the state of Texas on it. Right. And I knew that was going to be the thing that people were going to be able to rally around and deal with the profit motive, you know? So it's frustrating when you see, I mean, like New Orleans has been hit so hard, you know, in our lifetime, many times, you know, here, you know, we're in Texas, we're seeing mass failures of our electrical system. We're being warned when it gets 100 degrees that to turn down the AC because the AC system might fry. It's like,
right,
that's insane. You can't live here if you don't have air conditioning.
Right. Yeah.
I just want to take on that. Like, there's a bad precedent being set in New York because that also happened here. It was like a 98 or 99 degree day, and we all got this like Amber Alert style thing on our phones and said, turn the AC on, and people did it. And that lesson is going to be like, oh, we can just tell people to like cool it now. And that's not the message I want utility companies to be sending out. But
Yeah, no, totally. It's like, it's great that power outages can be avoided that way. And it would be so much more great if like anybody would actually take like making climate resilient homes more seriously. Yeah, I mean, with the energy thing too, like I think you see the same kind of thing where these big storms will happen, power will go offline, and then how do they pay for all the repairs that need to happen with the power lines? Like they just raise rates on taxpayers. You saw the same kind of thing obviously happen after the Texas cold front and stuff. Like I think people are, again, as you said, like really just really used to taking shit from all of these like fossil fuel interests. And you know, it's really, it's cool to have something like this, like the Texas Climate Jobs Project, to kind of raise expectations, I think.
Yeah, no, I think so too. And maybe to zoom out a little bit, because I don't know, this has become a bit of a theme of this show, because I think it's something that's really important, right? Which is sort of questioning and finding ways to politically challenge the power of these companies, you know, from like Entergy to deregulation in Texas. You know, PG&E is just a nightmare, right? You could throw plenty of other companies in there. But we see that like the profit motive doesn't deliver better services to people. Texas deregulation is a great example of that. People who are in the deregulated markets pay a whole hell of a lot more than people who are in city systems still, right? So the competition never really kicked in. You know, it's been 20 years now. you know, the profit motive doesn't make our, you know, these things cheaper for us. And it makes them dirtier and more unreliable.
Totally.
How do you think that we can start to like address this problem nationally? And then later I would sort of be interested to hear like what a different system might look like in your mind.
I mean, these are like the big, questions. Right. And I mean, I totally agree like that this, the whole reason I think to even like talk about any of this is to kind of figure out what it is that can be changed. Cause obviously like it doesn't have to be this way. I mean, I think that there's lots of things that people are already doing to try to, you know, hold these utilities and fossil fuel companies to account and make things better. You know, you mentioned that the profit motive is such a huge issue. I totally agree. And there's movements all over the country to, you know, bring utility companies under public control. And I think that's like obviously not a panacea, but it is, again, like, I think no question, I would rather have a company that was not paying off its shareholders and executives and everything than one that is.
Can I just make a note on the public control thing?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I 100% agree with you. I think sometimes socialists can be a little lazy with these things where it's like, oh, it is the profit motive and only the profit motive that is a problem. It's like, one, the profit motive is a problem, eradicate it, make them public. The advantage that public utilities have as like expanding democracy is that like we have more of an inroad to change these things, right?
100%.
Like, and I'm sure you know, I just wanted to highlight it again. It's like we have this power then to like really force the changes that we want to see done to our public utilities, versus right now where we're just like, please, Entergy, don't send, you know, 60 more actors to the city hall meeting being able to get the vote down.
Or even just sue us to stop it. Like reading the Battle of Blair Mountain, Chuck talking about like the modern coal industry, like basically saying we're not even worried about Hillary, and not because like she's a big sellout, but because like even if she does try something, we're just going to lock that stuff up in litigation. Like,
for sure. Yeah, totally. I mean, it's always better to have an entity that you can like directly govern, which is why, like, I mean, and I think that basically everyone who's working on these issues around the country knows that like it's not that, you know, you bring the companies under your public control tomorrow and then all of a sudden everything gets better. Like, we don't solve the climate crisis tomorrow just by simply like, you know, bringing all of these polluting companies under public control. But it starts something, right? Like, as you're saying, it's a way that you can actually start to govern them. Then you can have actually like democratically elected bodies that can actually, you know, force these companies to do something instead of these incentive sort of structures or like lawsuits or, you know, all of these kind of like extra governmental things. You can just be like, here's a bill, you have to listen to us. Yeah. And so definitely, like, I think getting rid of the profit motive is a huge part of that. There's some other, like, I think more like nerdy practical stuff too, that I think is really important. Like, you know, there's been, I think, especially in the wake of the coal front, in Texas, that was obviously really, really devastating. There were some calls to make a publicly controlled supergrid, which basically would like link all of the, there's three, I don't want to get into it too much, but there's three grids in the United States. There's like one for the East, one for the West, and then there's one for Texas. Y'all know this, like, you know, Texas has its own grid, which is like the cause of so many problems. But if you link all of them together, it means that if there's one part of the country that has an excess of solar power, for instance, you could like send it to a different part of the country. So I think like, and also then like, you know, you have a big publicly controlled thing that, again, you can regulate democratically, you can like govern directly. So yeah, there's other like more, you know, the nitty gritty kinds of solutions that I think are important to look at. But all of them, I think, start with that, like, you know, basically the principle of like democracy.
No, exactly. I mean, yeah, that's the only way we're going to get out of this, because we could come up with all the solutions that we want, but if we don't have the power to do it, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. Darna,
yeah.
I really, really appreciate you joining us this evening, and I would love it if you'd come on again sometime soon.
Yeah, I would love to. Thanks so much for having me. I'm such a huge fan. Stoked to be here.
We'll definitely, we'll put ways to follow Darna's work in the show notes. You can also check out her writings at Earther. Is there anything else we should be plugging for you?
I have a podcast series coming out on the Drilled podcast that we're collaborating with Drilled on with Earther, about another sort of fossil fuel industry propaganda thing, this one in schools, and that'll be out like at the end of the month, so be Ooh. Ready for that too.
Oh damn, well, we're looking forward to listening to that.
Yeah. Thanks.
Well, thank you again. We'll see you soon.
Yep, thanks. Great, Darna,
thank you so much.
See you.
Thanks.
All right, folks, we're gonna take a little quick break here, I think, and just probably about a minute, and then we'll be back with some Bitcoin more debunking. Sorry, guys, we haven't come around yet. I mean, we might make a lot of money if we turn into like former Bitcoin skeptics that are now proselytizers, but that's not what we do.
I'll do it for like 50K.
Really? How much? 50K over like just one lump sum?
I mean, what?
David, this is why we need to take a break.
Because I need to negotiate this.
I need to talk, David.
Maybe I'm cheap, man.
I need to talk David up. All right, folks, see you in a little bit. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Left Reckoners.
That was very interesting. The Entergy story is just so fascinating.
That is so delicious to me. The disclosures of emails like that, that show the nuts and bolts of how this stuff actually works. And just as like 2 weeks in a row, right? Like the Project X2 of let's force people to buy 2 EpiPens because we have a monopoly on it now. And let's come up with a medical justification. Oh, we can't. Well, who cares? And then this of how many bodies can we go and, you know, AstroTurf this meeting? Without people being like, without it being too much, who are these people? Fascinating stuff.
It's amazing, and too, like the fact that it's like a 100-year-old company. Well,
that's how you survive, baby.
We're talking about some things that, you know, something that has survived, which is the profit motive. We're going to talk about another kind of scam, a little bit different, new technology. We'll give them that. But I'm sorry, Bitcoin is a story, the way that it operates, the way that you make money off of it. This is a game as old as capitalism. And we're going to do our point-by-point conversation on Bitcoin. Matt already has his notebook right in front of him. But just to start here, we have this news peg about El Salvador, which has now, achieved the dream of many Bitcoiners. Which it has now, you know, allowed Bitcoin to be a national currency, right? Which, by the way, means that you have to accept Bitcoin if you are a merchant. Anyways, Matt will sort of break down for us the rollout and the many, many failures that happened.
Yeah, El Salvador's crypto conference attending president, Nayib Bukele, has promised $400 million in savings in remittance fees, which would be, you know, big savings because remittances are a big part of the economy. 20% of GDP, second only to Haiti and Nepal.
And do you mind? I'm just going to say for people who don't know what remittances are. Mm-hmm. Remittances are, you know, when you're a family who's working in the United States and you're sending money back to your family in El Salvador, right? And a lot of developing and third world countries are very reliant on that income.
Yeah. And so they've started this Chivo wallet, sort of the Bitcoin wallet. It was released September 7th. $30 million worth of public funds were put into this system to get the ball rolling. Now I want to share how that ball is rolling. This is from a YouTuber, Mark Falzone. This is not an anti-Bitcoin guy. This is, as far as I can tell, anyway. But you can see here there are some problems that will... We'll quote it a little bit more, but there's a certain string of words here that I find some of the most amazing language of all time. And it's not the fault of this YouTuber, it's just the way this system is set up.
Right. I'm here with Hassan.
Hey.
Filming another video. And Hassan, what time is it?
2 o'clock.
2 o'clock, and what's the date?
September 15th.
Can you show the camera so they know that I'm not lying?
He's so pissed.
Okay. On September 9th, I sent Hassan, on September 9th, Hassan sent me $10 from the Chivo app via Lightning to my Mun wallet.
Okay, sorry. I just can't get over how can this be good? The Chivo app to the Mum wallet.
You're right. Yeah, it's not really making things simple.
It sounds like somebody trying to make up bad sci-fi. Anyway, sorry.
I sent Hassan, on September 9th, Hassan sent me $10 from the Chivo app via Lightning to my Mun wallet. Has that money gone through yet?
No.
Fuck. Let me show you. You guys don't believe me. Pending. Scroll up.
You can see there.
Today's September 9th. There you go. Take your phone back. So, let me ask you guys a question.
It's a good question.
He sent me $10 for a video. But what if I was a merchant? What if I was a merchant who made my living selling motorcycles? And I needed
to sell her stolen motorcycle here. And he came in and he wanted to pay with Lightning or Bitcoin. By law, I must say yes. So what happens if he sends me $3,000 US or $4,000 or $5,000 US through Lightning to my app? And I'm not even using the Chivo app. I followed the advice of the Bitcoin influencers that I couldn't use the Chivo app, and I'm using my own custodial or non-custodial solution, the Mun wallet. The money gets stuck for 5 days. Do I give them the motorcycle? It doesn't show in my pending transactions. I don't have the money. The money's been deducted from his account and I saw him. Do I give him the motorcycle? Do I risk my livelihood?
So yes, these are questions that more and more people are asking. More and more El Salvadorian merchants are asking. Here's from Crypto News. Again, not an anti-crypto source as far as I know. Got some interesting sections here. So a tattoo art. Oh, here we go. El Diario de Hoy quoted two business owners speaking on conditions of anonymity who claimed that this is freedom. Speaking on conditions of anonymity, who claimed that in all the transfers that customers have made to them, they have lost money. I don't know if that is that a big problem. Is that a problem as far as business?
I think it'd be a problem for running a business.
I'm not a businessman. But I don't know if you go to the Shark Tank, you're like, I'm losing between 0.2 cents and 50 cents on every transaction. receiving between 0.2 and 0.50 less than the sale price. Well, one transaction, seeing them lose USD of $18.01. Again, nothing's perfect. I don't want to, you know, let a new technology, you know, let it get its wings going. Anyway, a tattoo artist, meanwhile, was quoted as stating that transactions took too long to process, called Chivo unnecessary. He opined that nobody will use a Chivo wallet, and that they had used up to USD 30 worth of Bitcoin they were given by the government as an incentive to download the app. So that's what I think there seems a lot of confusion about how we make like this 30 million, I think, of funds that we threw in to get the ball rolling. People are just cashing that out and then moving on, right? Like, which, I don't know, maybe that will turn out for the best. But yeah, an anonymous hair salon says, and a clothing salon say, one instance of transaction had failed for the customers using the app. In one case, the clothing outlet vendor stated, a customer attempted to pay for an item in Bitcoin twice, with the transaction failing in both instances. Finally, the customer gave up and left empty-handed, the vendor said. So
yeah, it has not been a good start. And you know, for people who aren't familiar with Bukele, like, you know, he is regarded as like the tech bro president, and you can see him when he's talking about Bitcoin in particular. It seems more often than not his audience is people in that kind of cyber libertarian world, Bitcoin enthusiasts, and American, you know, technologists, use a fancy word for them. Then people in El Salvador, it's the rollout has been a disaster. One look, you know, be fair. Some of it is certainly the app, but those are the kind of growing pains that happen when you try to introduce a whole new cyber currency, you know, to people. The problem with Bitcoin in particular, though, is that its issues go way beyond just a bad rollout and a bad app. From the get-go, the problem with Bitcoin is this. It's not a currency. Mm-hmm. It is an asset. And we'll get into that more in a little bit. But I just wanted to note right here in El Salvador, what they're noting about losing money on transactions is one of the big worries that people have about Bitcoin being used, for example, as a national currency, is that with something that is as volatile as that, it means the prices are constantly changing and shifting, right? And when you have a set price for something, right, but then because Bitcoin's value is going up and down, you know, day by day,
because a whale decided to invest in it and shit like that,
you can end up being really screwed. Yep. On top of it, from a government perspective, it could be an absolute nightmare. Imagine if I send out like your tax burden for the year, right? And then, you know, by law, like you know, whatever that number was is the set number. Well, you just wait until you get the right, you know, exchange rate on Bitcoin to dollars, et cetera. And then you pay in Bitcoin or vice versa. And then the government ends up losing tax revenue because of this system, right? It's a really, really volatile system. It's not something that's meant to be a currency. Again, I know there's a whole screaming horde of people out there who are mad. We're going to get in depth as to why, but we want to first start with what happened in El Salvador as a little bit of a prelude to the problems with this system.
Yeah, I mean, I always want to know from the people who get really mad at us if they're holding any crypto, because I'm not interested in hearing from the people holding it, honestly, about things like remittances, like serious issues. Like, okay, so here's this: the remittance issue has been talked about an awful lot by people that want to tout the liberatory potential of cryptocurrency. Let's just check in with our buddies at Quartz how that has turned out. Remittances in El Salvador are cheaper without using Bitcoin. Two different studies have shown that actually, no, that didn't turn out. So a false promise. Are people going to apologize for trafficking in the false promises of smaller remittance fees? I don't know. I don't think so. But I want to share this tweet. I think this was really well put by OLAASM on Twitter. Because, I mean, this is sort of what we've been saying about, but this is really well put. None of the missionary claims about Bitcoin in El Salvador hold up to real scrutiny, but they move the goalposts because this has never been about anything other than Bukele aligning with right-wing techno-fascists in a gamble to further consolidate power. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, that's the thing is, you could see which people care about more. When, mm-hmm. I mean, we're going to talk about, do you want to move on to keep going. Yeah, so we got this guy. He writes for this website. It's called Bitcoin Magazine. And we mentioned this one earlier. Can Bitcoin be Palestine's currency of freedom? We got another one. Finding financial freedom in Afghanistan. And then just this is all he does is go through and look at where people are struggling and then propose Bitcoin as the solution, Bitcoin in America, you know, fighting monetary colonialism with open source code, humanitarian and environmental case for Bitcoin, and checking your financial privilege. That was one I got a lot. Check your privilege. You don't send remittances to El Salvador, right?
Well, it turns out that you'd be much better using the traditional systems to do that than using this new Bitcoin system.
Yeah.
Right. I wanted to do this video particularly to push back against those kind of more glowing claims about Bitcoin. I will note maybe to start this segment, if it sounds good, too good to be true, it probably fucking is. We all know the term snake oil salesman, but who were those people historically? They were people who showed up to town. They told you that they were selling this magic ailment from the East, right? Where they got all this new technology out there and it's going to fix all your ailments, right? They'd sell out and then they move on to the next town, right? Bitcoin, the way that it's being sold is very, very much similar to this kind of system. Essentially, it's a product that people don't really, really.
Oh, I think I lost you, David. 1 second. We might need to take a test. 1, 2. Yeah, we'll take a shoot. Yeah. Oh, there we go. You're back.
Am I back now?
Yep.
I'm sorry. All right, maybe we'll edit that out. But yeah. Okay, back on that. Right when I was getting heated.
Yeah, I know. Sorry.
No. So, you know, the point of Bitcoin, just like any kind of scam product, is you want to be the person who's selling the shit to the other people, not the person who's buying when they realize that it's useless, right? Yeah. That's going to be how I'm going to start this conversation, because the social justice claims, the political justice claims, are really, really nasty. And I think there are a lot of people who listen to them and like are sympathetic. And look, I have no anger toward you at all. I think it's very easy to get caught up in these kind of new technologies, but I want to break down really clearly why these claims are false and why in fact they are quite dangerous. Are we ready?
Yep.
You know, so maybe first to start, like, what is Bitcoin for people who are unfamiliar? It's a digital currency, something that I would argue
currency.
Is more of an asset. Yeah. We'll get to the currency thing in a problem, but let's give it its fair due so people understand what we're talking about. This is something that takes a long ass time to fake, right? So it's not impossible, but it's virtually impossible, right? So there is a lot of faith in the actual Bitcoins themselves, right? And you don't go through a clearinghouse to exchange them, right? And this is going to be one of the fundamental aspects of Bitcoin, one of the big buzzwords that they use to sell it, which is decentralization, right? And we'll get into what that means, why it's bad, and does Bitcoin even really deliver on that later? But basically, there's two major ways that people hold Bitcoin, right? You either hold them on like a digital wallet, right? Which is basically you're going through a secondhand provider, which that starts to chip away at the kind of decentralization privacy claims that are made earlier. Or you do it the more old-fashioned and much, much, much more difficult way, right? That means holding your key, your unique key to your Bitcoin, either on a computer that's not connected to the internet, on a thumb drive. You've probably all seen Silicon Valley, where I can't remember the investor's name, but he's searching through the junkyard for his thumb drive that has like $1 billion of Bitcoin on it.
That's happened. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's happened, unfortunately, to a lot of people, you know, or, you know, old school stuff, like literally writing it down on a piece of paper, right? So this security that a lot of people push, you know, for Bitcoin, you know, oftentimes it falls on you, right? And I'm telling you right now, that is not the same thing as money in the damn bank. One, because it's not secure in the sense that like you could lose your shit and it's just gone forever. And two, because you don't want to be the one holding Bitcoin when that market starts to fall. Right. And you don't like, you want to be exchanging your Bitcoin for US dollars or euro or yen, right? Bitcoin, again, is valuable to people because they think that they can sell it for a higher price than they bought it. And just one more thing too, for people who, again, who are not familiar at all with Bitcoin, there's a limited amount of coins. They haven't all been mined yet. And the way that they're mined is through an extremely complicated computer program, right? That takes up a lot of computing power and is extremely wasteful. And we'll get all into that a little bit later, right? But like the kind of early idea was that, oh, people can just do a little bit of mining for Bitcoins, right? And they can exchange them and make some money off of that. And that also supports the network itself, right? But as we'll get into later, the Bitcoin mining networks are highly centralized. There's pretty much only a handful of companies that are responsible for the vast majority.
And David, are those capitalist organizations or are those like co-ops or what kind of organizations are those?
Most definitely capitalist. Right. Okay. I mean, is that enough of a technical description?
Yeah, I think that's great.
Let's get into like the real factors of Bitcoin and why we figured we need to talk about it. One, because, you know, of what's happening in El Salvador, but two, because it is oftentimes brought up as this kind of solution to problems, right? And I'm going to put the Bitcoin camp, the Bitcoin folks, the pro Bitcoin folks into two camps, right? The true believers, right? The folks who really do think that we've stumbled upon some new technology that is going to upend economics. It's going to drive down inequality, and it's finally going to break the power of the rich and powerful, right? Mm-hmm. Sorry to tell you, that's not the truth, right? But then there's the second group of folks, right? Maybe, I don't know, maybe it's too glib, but you call them prospectors, right? These are folks who want to get rich quick. And there's all different levels of these folks, right? There are folks who might have invested at the right time and they've made some money. I want to say here right now, you can make money on Bitcoin. A lot of people have, right? People need to understand what it is and how they're doing it, right? And understand that essentially it's just gambling. Bubba, I love gambling like the next guy. I love poker. I love football betting, right? I do it too, right? It's fun. It's a thrill. But I'm not over here telling you to put everything on the Dallas Cowboys to get yourself out of fucking trouble, right? Because that would be irresponsible. And again, so you can make money through Bitcoin speculation, just like you can on stock market speculation, just like you can on sports betting. You know, Bitcoin is notable for the get rich people because if you get in at the right time, you can make good money. People love to cite, you know, the fact that if you go back to, you know, 2011, if you had $1,000 in Bitcoin, you know, you would have upwards of, you know, $2.7 million, right? Yeah, I mean, we can, you know, scroll down to that. But look, they go through all the different times that if you bought Bitcoin, then you would win, right? But here's
easy to do retrospectively.
It's really easy to do that retrospectively. There have been other kind of attempts at this that didn't pan out. And obviously it would be absurd at that moment in time for people to be investing $1,000 in Bitcoin because at that time it was primarily just being, you know, chucked around anarcho-capitalist forums and as an early currency of the Silk Road. Right. And I think we're going to do a little bit more of that history on our show next week. So I won't get into that as much today. But know that for every victory, there is defeat. And this is the fundamental mechanism of making money on Bitcoin, right? For you to be a winner, you buy low and you sell high. That's old school, man. That's capital speculation 101. You put the least amount of money in as possible, and then you sell when you think that it's got the right price, right? When it's reached its height. And if you do that right, you make money. But for you to do that, you need another buyer. Right? Somebody to buy when it's at its height, right? It's basically somebody to give a bunch of their money away, you know, to buy something from you at an extremely, extremely high inflated price, right? And look, sometimes that person can make some money, but more often than not, and you see it with all of these kind of volatility bubbles on Bitcoin, people buy at the wrong time. They buy when, you know, there's a lot of articles on CNBC about how this is just going. And people lose fortunes. Working people lose fortunes.
And can we think just through the psychology of someone who buys at the wrong time? They buy and then a dip happens and you own all this stuff. What do you think you would be incentivized to say about that stuff? Would you be incentivized to be real about the value of it? Or would you? Exactly, of course. Right? That's why, like, you know, you put it into true believers and, like, you know, profiteers. Like, I think there is, like, within true believers, I think it's weird to, like, be proselytizing this stuff and not hold it. At the same time, that's the only way I respect it. Because I think if you are simultaneously saying, like, I own this much crypto and I check, you know, the rise of it just to see, like, and I'm thinking about when I can get out, and you're simultaneously wanting and pitching this to, like, Palestinians or Afghan people, that is evil. You want to leave them holding it while you cash out? I mean, sick.
No, exactly. And, like, all of this, the talk that we're getting about how this is the future currency, again, for people who are seething right now, we're going to break down why it doesn't work as a currency in a second. But I wanted to start with the most cynical group, right? And I think the group that's driving most of the movement on this, by the way.
Yes.
Which are these people who understand it for what it is, right? Which is currently unregulated, for the most part, avenue for high stakes speculation. For people who are not familiar, speculation is inherent to capitalism, right? That's one of the oldest games in the book, right? And there's a reason why it is highly regulated, because of this kind of shit, right? Because this kind of high stakes, you know, essentially gambling, creates wild claims, you know, malicious actors, right? Misinformation. Right. Let that be known. Right. It is speculation. And again, people do this with a lot of different stuff. It's not just cryptocurrency. People do this with US dollars, right? Or with the euro. People have made fortunes on currency speculation in general. And that's not a good thing either.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying right here is that, like, speculation is not unique to crypto, but that is the engine behind cryptocurrency. That's why when you see that its price has risen, it's because there's a lot of speculation on it, right? It's a game. Again, let me just put this really simply for folks who might not be following me. What is speculation? Simply put, it's when you buy an asset and you hope that its value will increase over time. And again, for you to win, it means that someone else must pay. If you've ever heard the phrase holding the bag, this is where it comes from. Holding the bag is what happens when you are the person who has the speculative asset, right? So you've spent the money on the speculative asset when the price collapses or the price drops, right? Meaning you lose the money, right? You're the sucker. You lost the game. And that is primarily where this game goes, right? Again, you might make money, plenty have, but you might lose it. Hey man, I'm glad. Like, honestly, like, hell yeah. Like, I love it when my boys win, right? But just understand what this shit is. You got yours. But let's just, like, be straight that this is speculation, but just the new, with the new concept backing it. But anyways, enough with the get rich quick folks, right? Let's talk about the true believers, and feel free to jump in here, Matt, with any of these points. But I wanted to get through like the main kind of criticisms of money and why, as a current, like, I'm going to get into a second why Bitcoin practically isn't good, right? Why it doesn't deliver on these promises. But I really wanted to start here, like, as a socialist, why, when I first saw this starting to develop, right, why I already was suspicious, right, before I recognized the problems with the technology itself. I want to talk about why the rich and powerful and anarcho-capitalist free marketeers have wanted what is called private money for a long ass time, right? You know, there's a few camps in Bitcoin. The vast majority are libertarians, anti-government, anarcho-capitalists. And again, I do see some leftists getting wrapped up in it. And like, this is there's no ill will here or malice. I just want to help you understand why this is not something that what is being told to you is not true about this system, right? Money is really complicated. But I really want to start by making a kind of cheap and easy distinction between, you know, fiat money, the money that's coming from the government, and private money. Fiat money is the money that's issued by the government. In the United States, it used to be backed. Our dollars used to be backed by precious metals. But as the rest of the world also soon discovered, that's not a great way to organize an economy. Because if your monetary system is going up and down with the buying and selling of gold, its limited nature, the price of it, this has outsized weight on the money supply in the economy. A government, and you got to remember this, this is what we were talking about earlier with Darna. A government, you have to think, is a public arena. Yes, it's bought and controlled by really powerful interests, but this is a public arena, something that we need to be aiming to capture, right? A government needs to be able to control the money supply, because you can do a lot of different things with the money supply that help the rich. No doubt about it. The Federal Reserve does things to help out the rich. But you can also do things that help out the poor. You can do things that help out exporters versus importers. You can do things that benefit financial capital against the interest of industrial capital. What I'm saying right here is that monetary policy is a power that the government has to sort of to pull at the levers of the economy to get certain kind of outcomes. And if you're a leftist and you're sort of in the kind of Bitcoin world because you have been shown how the Federal Reserve works against working people, I think that this is a great bridge for you to jump off, right? Because your head is in the right place. But the answer is not private money. A great example of this, and how horrible central banks can be is like, read any book or interview from Yanis Varoufakis, right, when he talks about central bank policy. These organizations are really anti-democratic in their current, in the way that they exist currently. But the solution is not to give a gift to the rich and powerful and people who want private money. It's to capture these kind of things to make them work for people, because that power, right, over monetary policy is something that you do not want to eradicate from the public sphere, right? Because capitalists and the rights, they've always despised government money. Matt probably knows this better than me, yeah, in U.S. history.
Well, it's like, I can't, no examples come to mind, but it's just the way to think about it is about the word decentralization is that's a marketing term. And if this was at a time where markets were seen favorably, like in the 90s or something like that, it'd be called privatization of money. And everybody on the left would know exactly what fucking time it is.
No, I think that's a great way to think about it. And like, just to make it really clear, why do the wealthy want money that's not tied to the government? One, because as we mentioned earlier, they fear it being used to weaken their power in the economy. Two, because they are afraid of confiscation, taxation, monetary policy that might interfere with them hoarding their wealth. For example, things like capital controls. And that is one of the big pitches, by the way, for Bitcoin, is that you can use it to bring money out of an economy that is trying to implement capital controls. I don't have time to get into capital controls and a whole thing, but that is one thing that socialists need to be prepared to embrace, because if you want to deal with financial capital, the power of the rich and powerful, we need to utilize our ability to implement capital controls. Anyway.
Yeah, not encouraging ways to skirt them.
Yeah. And I mean, regarding skirting, I mean, criminals obviously share these fears as well, which is why it's no surprise a lot of early Bitcoin history is Silk Road, right? A site for people who aren't familiar, where you could buy drugs and a lot of other illicit items. again, you need to understand that money is a public good. And yes, it's not serving us well right now, but giving that power to the private sector will have a damaging result on our ability to implement left policies. Yeah. And so that's like the kind of like larger argument about why we don't want private money in general. But let's talk about Bitcoin now a little bit more specifically, right? Because, you know, if we talk about money like this too much, we're like doing too much of service to Bitcoin, because Bitcoin does not function like a proper currency. Did you know that only 1.3% of existing Bitcoin is used to make transactions, Matt?
Interesting.
The vast majority of it is bought to hold, bought to speculate on, right? Exactly like what we were talking about. So all this kind of thing, like, oh, this is a payment solution, blah, blah, blah. It's not being utilized in that way at all, right? And any kind of promise, as we are seeing in El Salvador, of it being, you know, the potential of being able to do something else, you know, are very quickly facing the kind of technical realities of that problem. Again, the vast majority of this shit is being used to try to bet correctly so that individuals can make some money, right?
Yeah. Well, it's funny, just to go on El Salvador for a little bit, like, if anything comes good from the Chivo app, it'll be like a non-crypto related expansion of banking access, which could have just been done by something like postal banking. Yes. Which absolutely should be done. It should be done here. It should be done in El Salvador to get people banked in a way that's not by a predatory financial institution.
And building digital payment infrastructure is also a good thing, right? But like, let's, you know, these are the main claims from like the believers, right? The decentralization stuff, right? When we sort of broke down why like the decentralization in the sense of hiding your money from the government is not a good thing. Two, Bitcoin is already starting to fail at that promise because, as I was saying earlier, the Bitcoin mining operations have become highly, highly centralized. And again, for people who might not follow this really closely, might not get what the problem with that is, that those mining operations end up being able to exert large amounts of power over the entire system as a whole, right? So the promise that it's sort of just like, you know, some floating system are not borne out by that reality. I want to, everyone always talks about the environmental waste. I think that it's worth talking about, but I think it's talked about so much that I don't want to miss out on the other reasons that it sucks. But if you could just pull up this piece right here, you talk about the waste of electricity and carbon that goes into it. People don't talk a lot enough about the e-waste problem. This is amazing right here. This is from a piece that came out December 2021 in the academic journal Resources, Conservation, and Recycling. That notes that Bitcoin's annual e-waste generation adds up to 30.7 metric kilotons as of May 2021. On average, Bitcoin generates 272 grams of e-waste per transaction. Look, I'm not somebody who deals with grams very much, so just like as like to help you understand what that is, the new iPhone that just came out, that its entire weight is 141 grams, right? So with each transaction, that is how much is being wasted. Just to make this really clear for folks who might have a hard time sort of piecing these together, how the e-waste is created, it's created because to maintain this system of Bitcoin, you have to have all of these computers using an incredible amount of their computing power, right, to go through these extremely complicated math problems, right? Which again is a real waste of our resources and the electricity. But it also means that those machines have to be, you know, they die, right? They break down eventually. And that's what they're talking about when they're talking about the e-waste that is created just in one transaction. But we're going through some of the other things here. You know, one of the big things that people in Bitcoin argue is a good thing is like, there's no chargebacks, right? Which means that, you know, this kind of idea that people are constantly saying, oh, this charge against my credit card was false, right? As a kind of scam, right? One, that's a really shitty argument. One, because how many times have you gotten a bad charge against you, Matt? Isn't it a nice thing to have all of your, you know, the money that's coming in and out of your bank account being sort of supervised by a regulatory system that makes sure that fraud is addressed? The problem with Bitcoin is they come at banks and financial institutions, just like they talk about, you know, inequality, right? These are problems. Banks are evil, right? Financial institutions are horrible, right? But you miss You're fixating so much, like you're making the mistake here by forgetting like what banks potentially can be doing. Without banks, you have no security and no protection from fraud. Currently, the money that's sitting in your bank account is backed by the U.S. government. If your bank loses your money, you get your money back. Bitcoin losses, you lose, sucker. You get scammed. Better luck next time.
Yeah, what do we? I feel like I'm going crazy. What? How is when banks call me and say my credit card was used in Sioux Falls, do I need to cancel it? And I say yes. That's not the thing I don't like about banks. Exactly. That's the thing criminals don't like about banks.
Look, again, the solution to the problems with banking in the financial sector are by winning public power, right? And taking over those systems and making them work for us. It's not putting all of our money out into the open in this way that we can just be scammed and potentially lose it all. I mean, also, you know, just frankly, just losing your money is also an extremely frightening. That's why people put their money in the bank in the first place, because we also realize that just everybody having large amounts of cash sitting around their homes was not good. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like you're reinventing the wheel again. You're creating new problems. But beyond this, it can't function as currency. Why? One, because of its volatility, right? I don't want Matt to buy something from me, and then 6 hours later, the money that Matt gave me be half the value that it was a few hours ago. And vice versa, right? It creates a lot of problems in any kind of economy when you have massive price fluctuation. The Bitcoin people all say that once there's enough enough users, enough people using it, that will go down. But I'm telling you right now, no, because the only reason that the value is continuing to go up is because people are speculating on it. They're not using it as currency. Why? One, because most places don't accept Bitcoin. And two, because transactions are unbelievably slow. They're talking that most transactions are taking around 7 seconds to process just one of those, right? And that's on a good day. Yeah. Because think about it. If there are transactions going on all around the world with Bitcoin, that means that you're getting further and further backed up in line, right? And if it does become utilized on a mass scale, you're going to be seeing massive delays in your payment system, as we saw already in El Salvador.
Yeah, and somebody wanted us to comment on Cuba. There's a headline, Cuba to recognize and regulate crypto on the island. Now, it remains to be seen what this is. Somebody said, like, will you be covering Cuba's embrace of crypto? Recognize and
embrace would be the wrong word.
Exactly. Recognize and regulate is not what I would call an embrace. It is notably not, as we've been talking about, as a currency. It's an asset that they're monitoring.
Again, people buying assets, I can buy future, right? I can buy all sorts of things, right, that we treat as assets in the United States economy that are different from currency.
Yeah.
I want to sort of walk through these, because I want the last bit of this. I know this has gone long. I hope this is juicy for folks. The last bit is going to be specifically about these kind of left social justice things. But I want to make sure that, we just sort of get through the kind of like neutral criticism of this. Which is that, yeah, the transactions are a nightmare. It can't be a bank. It cannot function as a bank, because you don't want to store value in highly volatile assets. You don't do that. And it's absurd to try to push that on people too in other parts of the world. That Palestinian piece that we had earlier, basically the whole story is a really, accurate telling of what's happening in Palestine, the horrors of occupation. And then sort of towards the end of it is just some guy saying, we're saving up money, right? And we're going to a provider. Oh, which is another important thing to say, by the way, right, about the decentralization. You have to go through these secondhand systems if you're somebody in these countries. Why? Because how many people in Palestine do you think have a state-of-the-art computer and constant access to the internet? Hell, they don't even have constant access to electricity. That's the fucking problem, Bubba, right? Like the reason that, that a lot of people are unbanked is because the infrastructure around them, both digitally and physically, has been damaged, is prevented, they're prevented access, or frankly, because, they're just extremely rural, right? This kind of thing, like, so you're going to have to go through a secondhand provider. Anyways, the story of Palestine goes that people are going to secondhand providers and they're saving up money and they're watching the markets for Bitcoin. And as they say in the piece, we're learning to buy at the dip, right? That's not people embracing a new currency. That's people learning how to, you know, try to ride waves and gamble. And look, I'm more than, out of anybody, I'm more than happy that somebody in Gaza, right, can make some fucking money off of this shit, right? If they can make money off of it. I'm not against that in principle, but I am certainly against this being presented as a solution.
Structural prescription. Yeah, exactly.
It's not a bank solution because you don't want to hold your assets in this highly volatile, you know, asset. And also don't forget, again, as we said earlier, if you can't buy goods and services with it, as we said earlier, 1.3% of the transactions are those, you know, are actual transactions for things, right? If you can't use it to buy goods and services, what do you have to do? Well, you have to transfer it either into US dollars or to whatever currency your country recognizes as legal tender, which always means that there's going to be mismatches. Right. When you're withdrawing these things at the right time, you're going to be relying on these, you know, on the ups and downs of the Bitcoin market. It doesn't work as a banking system. Right. And lastly, as Matt noted at the very beginning of this, remittances, it doesn't work for remittances. We've seen that time and time again, not just in El Salvador, but in the Philippines and many other places where people have tried to push this as a solution. You know, there definitely can be a lot done to make remittances better. I truly believe that expanding digital like currency, right, access to digital banking, things like that, will be a benefit to people, right? I'm all for that. But you don't need to go through the middleman. Like for me to send money to somebody who needs it, for it to go to transfer into Bitcoin and then to transfer back into USD on the other side is a wasteful.
Literally.
Step both in time but also in risk
and like CO2 and e-waste and all that stuff. Yeah.
So maybe left in Bitcoin, and I unless you had any things that you wanted to add to it, I want to sort of note the three tenets of like people who are lefties who push it.
Cool.
Because I've been trying to understand it too, frankly.
Yeah.
Because I see people push it a lot and I never understand what they are leaning on. Some people lean on it as a solution to wealth inequality because you could potentially make money off of it, right? Well, again, this isn't a solution to wealth inequality.
Unless every single poor person could, I mean, for an individual, maybe it's a solution to inequality.
Yeah, like, hey, again, like make some money gambling, man. Like, you know, that's fine. But yeah, it's not a solution to poverty on that level, on the speculation side of it, right?
Right.
So that's just is completely bunked.
Ridiculous.
And let's also like let's be good like Marxists here, right? This is something that has no relation to actual material production, right? this is not something that is based on like people actually producing a product that is useful, right? This is people trying to buy something at the low price and sell it at the high price, right? This is the most excessive aspect of capital, right? This is the kind of shit that Marx is writing about in volume 3 when they're sort of laying out the kind of giddiness of capitalists, which is trying to find a way to make money without production, right? Because they want to weaken the power that us workers have. Right. They want to get around the problem. Right. The problem for them is that they have to exploit us to make money. Right. And speculation has always been the way that they try to get around it. But the problem with speculation, as you've seen in any other example, has been that eventually those markets fail. Right. Because they are not based on actual material reality. Right. So this kind of idea that it's like, you know, having poor people around the world speculate on it is a solution to inequality is bullshit. The idea that it's anti-bank, right? This is the big one that people say. It's like, don't you hate the banks? The banks are bad. The banks exploit everybody, et cetera, right? Bitcoin is no fucking better. It has no protections for you. It allows rich people to hide their money. It's extremely volatile, just like even like a perfect system level, right? You just don't want your bank account to be going up and down constantly. And you have to do your own fucking security. No, thank you. That is not a solution, you know, to the problem of massive banks. Do you know what is the solution to massive banks that have outsized power? Taking those under public control and making them serve the interests of people.
Yeah.
Right? That's a big thing to do. That's what our politics is all about. But that's the solution. There is no fucking quick way around this. And it's certainly not buying into some kind of speculation scam. The other thing is people argue is that it's anti-finance, right? You can opt out of the system. You're not opting out of the system. You're opting into something that is just old school casino capitalism, man, right? And at the end of the day, you're not even fucking opting out, because what you want to do with your Bitcoin is to exchange it for United States dollars.
Yeah. You want to opt back in at a more advantageous position. Can I opt out of finance and then look, opt back in and look at, I got a big stack of dollars now.
Yeah. You don't want to hold on to, like, you might want to hold on to it and sell it at the right time. But at the end of the day, what you're holding on to, the goal of that move on your part is to exchange it for US dollars.
Yep.
Lastly, it's the development one, touches on all of these. This is not going to help the unbanked. Remember Libra, same kind of bullshit too. And when Facebook was trying to do this,
I forgot about that.
Yeah. Bring more and more. And that was even more ridiculous, honestly. Unbanked people, right? It's all, it's inefficient. The transactions are way too slow. So that's not going to help people who need help getting the financial system, the volatility, as we mentioned over and over. And you have to go through platforms, because as I mentioned earlier, secondhand platforms, people do not in those parts of the world have fancy ass computers that are constantly connected to the internet. All of these kind of developments of like the Bitcoin ideology are just ways to sell it to you. Because you know what? For every leftist who really buys into it, there is a right-wing website that is making arguments as to why Bitcoin is the answer to all the things that you want to see in politics. And it's one of those things, your radar should be going up when they're saying something to every single person, right? That is the answer to all of the problems that they have. Because at the end of the day, this is a speculation scam.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said time and time again, if you want people to buy the thing that you have, right, for a higher price than you bought it for, what do? You convince them that it's really, really fucking shiny. It's really, really, really good. It's really, really, really valuable, right? At the end of the day, there's nothing behind this system that is of value, that has inherent value. It's all about people's feelings about it. It does not provide the kind of structural solutions that might attract some of the left-wing people to it. And from the get-go, it has just been a way for some people who got in before everybody else to sell it to the latecomers. And in that way, it is just like any scam that has ever existed in capitalism.
Well, and the media itself is like, what's the business lesson from the gold rushes that this country has experienced? It's You sell stuff to the people going to do the fucking digging to try to find gold, right? And that's all these media people that are like doing hours of content. They're getting a lot of eyeballs of people that are trying to like, okay, which one of these crypto choices do I invest in to get the best, you know, return? And what's the future look like? And like David said, a lot of money on that side of things and preparing people for how best to navigate this future of currency. And it's bullshit. But I want to ask you, David, what your prescription is, because when it comes to certain things, I'm afraid of being authoritarian. Free speech is one issue. I'm trying to turn my free speech, for instance. Brett Weinstein, I criticize him. I don't call him to be censored, although I do want him to be understood as a charlatan who is dangerous and even deadly to his audience. As far as crypto goes, ban it. I'm not afraid about being authoritarian to the class of speculators. I'm sorry, ban it. It shouldn't exist anymore. It shouldn't be making e-waste. It shouldn't be using that e-stuff in the first place, so the point that I can't buy a fucking PlayStation 5 a year after that shit launched, or like people's like car productions down. Are you fucking kidding me that we have all this actually necessary production that needs to be done, because, and we have a chip shortage in part because of these motherfuckers making online monopoly money to sell to some asshole that they can like take their greenbacks? Like it really sucks, and yet we're not afraid to take the heat on this. I'm sorry, like, I appreciate that there are certain people that are, like David said, in this for the right reasons and want to believe it. But like, I'm sorry, I'm not seeing it. And like, we've been dealing with Bitcoin for a long ass time. Like, as long as I've been doing this professionally, and I've not seen an argument that doesn't make me wonder like how much you're hoping the price goes up so you can cash out yourself.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I've never seen anybody be able to make a coherent argument as to why it's of value to like the left in general. And certainly like, it's like private money is something that I'm opposed to just like in concept.
Absolutely. Right?
But in practice, this is something that just doesn't seem to be working. And look, I mean, like when it comes to, you know, the general feelings about banning it versus not banning it, if we had the switch, you know, I think in general, I probably would lean to just like treating it like all of the other, you know, speculative assets out there. But then when you remind me about the waste, the environmental waste, it's just like, you know, if we're having to make decisions on stuff like that going forward, oh, I'm sorry, Bitcoin's the first thing to go.
Yeah. Oh man, I would love it. I would love to be the president who kills this thing. Cause yeah.
Well, we got a lot in on this Bitcoin go.
We might talk. Yeah. I just want to cut in there.
Yeah.
Because we might talk a little bit more about like blockchain, for instance. We got a guy, I don't want to say too much, but I think we'll have him next week to talk about Bitcoin even more. So,
yeah. So there'll be even more about this. And if that's not enough, we'll see. I think we're going to do it in the post game. I have a list from one of the big Bitcoin websites of their top 10 rebuttals to the major criticisms of Bitcoin. Because I'm sure there are people who think we didn't give them a fair shake. Matt and I will do a kind of rapid fire response to their defenses of their system in the post game, along with Matt is going to take us through the history of Occupy Democrats, the most annoying account on both Facebook and Twitter for Bum Steer. And what else we got for them?
I've got a few things in the post game, some fun stuff. Daily Wire, the guys sitting around smoking cigars in their like backstage area, going to tell us why Barack Obama killed rock and roll in a way that is so cringe that even Ben Shapiro seems uncomfortable. We're going to be talking about the massive, massive FBI scandal going on now with the abused Olympians and Larry Nassar. Like, honestly, like we've talked about the FBI quite a lot recently on this show, but what the Larry Nassar thing, I mean, talk to your family about it. We need to get those approval ratings for the FBI down, because I mean, we're going to get into it, but just egregious cover up of sexual abuse of fucking Olympians that like everybody has seen. I mean, it's the sort of thing like who's safe and what structurally is going on in this country and who is it designed for? And we'll also talk about in lighter news, Tesla they've reinvented the wheel, David. I don't know if you saw this story. It'd be funnier if you haven't seen it. You're going to laugh your ass off. And then, and then I think that would be good enough. We got maybe a few other things, but patreon.com/leftreckoning. We just crossed 900. Help us push us. We only get this last 100. So I can get down to Austin and have some more of David's brisket.
And we'll be doing a grill stream there too.
We'll start grill streaming. That's going to be a big part of Left Reckoning 2022, I think. So
see y'all there.
All right. See you, folks.